Session number 8735, Dr. Reginald Saxton, Part 8.
Now, at the Battle of Teruel, which was a battle where Teruel was captured and then was lost again, following which the fascists advanced to the sea and have split the Republican forces into two. It was a very hard battle, there were a lot of heavy losses. The terrain was very difficult, it was mountainous and muddy and snowbound in part of the time, most of the time. Very cold. Our patients were treated in all sorts of odd buildings and we were subject to air attack. And to snipers, even if you got anywhere near the enemy side of the town. But we did acquire a lot of equipment, foreign equipment, a great deal of it, which was in Teruel at the time it was taken. I refer to medical equipment, material useful for a laboratory, glassware and such like. And so when we had recovered from this, came out of this battle of Teruel, where we had done what we could with various rushes of wounded and various idle moments when you're expecting wounded and it might come any moment and didn't, and it's a very trying situation altogether, because it was also unpredictable and so cold and so miserable in many ways. But we came out with much more equipment of sort of medical or laboratory type than we went in. And sometime about that time, I acquired a very large vehicle. Well, I think it was specially built up on lines that a body is built on it, more or less according to my specifications on this great truck. And this body was a laboratory with benches down two sides, a refrigerator in one corner, I think a sterilizer in another corner, and across the width of this wide vehicle, a couple of bunks for me and my assistant, somewhere between the driving part of the front of the vehicle and the laboratory at the back, so that we were more or less self-sufficient organization. We had cupboards and for holding lots of our reagents and other materials. And as I say, this refrigerator where we could store blood when we had it to store. But I never got down to, and I never intended to get down to, actually drawing blood for storage. Because this required rather more facilities and capacity for getting the exact quantities and sterile conditions and the donors carefully examined beforehand, and all these facilities for actually taking blood for storage, I did not attempt to emulate as it was done in Barcelona and Madrid, and whichever was the nearer of these two centres, I would try to get blood for storage from them and put it in my refrigerator and keep it until it was needed. Mind you, couldn't keep it indefinitely, but for a fortnight anyway, or whatever, it was usually quite safe to use. So this is my laboratory and transfusion vehicle, which from then on I took with me and a driver. And I don't think There was one other permanent assistant. I don't know how the three of us made it. I expect the driver stepped on the front seat or something. Anyway, there's myself and an assistant and driver. We were always with this vehicle, and occasionally in certain places where we stopped for a reasonable length of time, we did accumulate on one occasion, at any rate, two other laboratory assistants. Three others. One was an Italian and two Americans. So this laboratory then, when we were stationed long enough, took on jobs of ordinary laboratory work, and we offloaded the equipment then. I remember we went to a town called Valls, V-A-L-L-S, not far from Tarragona, which is on the sea. And there there was quite a big stationary hospital, you might say, a civilian hospital then, that was being used as for military purposes, and we opened up our laboratory there, and we would do all sorts of fairly complicated tests. I mean, one stage people were afraid they were being poisoned by arsenic, and we had to test various foodstuffs. Ridiculous thing, really, but we had to rig up apparatus. We had, fortunately, certain reference materials there to sort of work it out, but with these two American laboratory assistants we did pretty well and satisfied ourselves that the salt was not contaminated with arsenic as was suspected. And then we had to test, I remember, the local farmers, or Swansea farmers, the goat herds were selling goat's milk to the hospital. They suspected the milk was being watered, and that the hospital funds were being swindled by paying for water as well as for the salt and the milk. So we were set this problem of determining whether the milk supplied by the goat herds was watered or not. And this took a bit of thinking out, because we didn't know much about goat's milk. And in the end, we hit on a brilliant idea, a simple idea. We went out and found a goat herd and demanded that he give us a pint of milk, or it was milked straight out of the goat. And then we took the milk as we got it out of the goat and compared it in various ways by boiling it down and measuring the residue and this sort of thing, with the milk that the hospital had. And we came to the conclusion that the milk that the hospital was getting was about one third of it just water. So no drastic action was taken, as one might have feared, perhaps, with always the suspicion of violence in wartime. No, the hospital simply declined to pay for the one third water and only paid the two thirds of the milk. And that soon settled that problem, and there seemed to be no complaints anywhere. There was no. So I think I was always afraid, though, you know, that, I mean, I'm not a pathologist, and here I was trying to do certain pathological tests which I had no previous experience and worked out from books, but with, fortunately, these two quite good laboratory workers from the States, and this one from Italy. He was good too, so that I had some excellent assistance there. But we had blood donors, a group of blood donors, and we I used to do the blood grouping in this little laboratory, and we collected quite a nice little volunteer corps of blood donors. Sometimes the civilian difficulties and differences would overflow a little bit into us. You see, I mean, we were insulated to a large extent, being just a medical unit working for the army. We were insulated very much from civilian troubles that existed. Just occasionally, where the contact became closer, the civilian difficulties would overflow into our work. And getting together volunteer blood donors meant contact with the various civilian organisations who might provide or help us to recruit these donors. And there was obviously a little bit of antagonism between them, and the Socialist Party would be a bit edgy about the Communist Party or the Republican group or party. You know, who was the person who was really going to organise it? Who was the more important of these three organisations? And well, if they're going to take it on, let them get on with it. We're not going to help. Well, that sort of attitude did occur now and then, of feelings of resentment between these groups, which interfered to a large extent, even in little ways like that, sort of the welfare side of the hospital with the patients. See, we were stationary for some time in Valls, and these things began to seep through. There were these difficulties and just differences between the different parties supporting the Republic. And of course, if you look at the wider spectrum and knew more about the... as we didn't know a great deal about it ourselves, but until later perhaps. There were so many serious differences, in many respects serious.
Yes, I wonder how important that was to the outcome.
Oh, I think it did make a big difference. A big difference. You see, very often, and apart from the sort of secondary civil war that took place in Barcelona, as you know, and there was fighting between anarchists and possibly the Trotskyists and the central government, or who were supported by the communists, which lasted for, I don't know, a week or so, something like that. Apart from that, there's always this little bickering under the surface and a tendency not to do too much to help the other lot. Part of the time, the central forces towards the end, under General Miaja in Madrid, when we wanted them, and I think the central government really wanted them, to coordinate their attack when the Ebro was crossed, so that the fascist forces wouldn't be able to bring tremendous reinforcements from the central front towards the south or east. When we crossed the Ebro, they should have attacked on the other side as well, so that we should have coordinated the attack on the enemy. But the expected attack from the other side never took place, and so we were all driven back, ultimately back across the Ebro again, and that was the beginning of the end. Well, General Miaja was very much blamed for not bringing his forces to bear. He had 300,000 soldiers and his command, he was saving them to save himself and Madrid at the end, and to be able to have something with which to bargain for the final surrender, we think. And that probably was the last time the war might have swung in our favour, if that attack across the Ebro had been coordinated with an attack from the Madrid side. That would have cut off the forces of the enemy who had gone on from Teruel down to the Mediterranean. Well, perhaps you've got off the mark, but I had this... Well, we were talking about the transfusion service and the laboratory, the mobile laboratory, which I had. And that then moved around where we went, and it... after Teruel, then the main final offensive was across the Ebro.
And you actually went there with your lab, did you? Your mobile lab. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, now, the Ebro offensive, at the stage then, the front line was along the Ebro, the two sides of the river. One was held by one side, one by the other. Now, the left-hand bank of the river was in Republican hands, the right hand in the fascist hands. And it was a very well-planned offensive from our side, from the Catalan side, you might say, the Catalonia, and it was supposed to be coordinated with the corresponding attack from the other side. And there were the fascist forces in the middle. And it was very well organized, I think, as far as I could see from our side, because we came, first of all, and set up a hospital in some caves on the left-hand side, on our side of the river, fairly near, to receive casualties from the first beginnings of this attack, or the preparations there. I can't remember quite what stages was which, but we had this hospital in this cave, the cave was on two levels inside. It had been sort of levelled up inside, but it was very nicely protected by this enormous sort of hill over the top of it, and it was lit up with electric lighting. There was a dynamo at one end, we had an American with a dynamo illuminated the place for us, an engineer of some kind. And then one level there was a ward mainly, and I think an operating room there must have been. I can't quite visualise. Yes, an operating room. And then on another level there was another ward, and in the end we found that we were using one ward for Republican soldiers and the other ward for prisoners of war. There were a lot of Italians at that stage for some reason, I think. Anyway, that's how it was organised. And then in the valley, a little bit below the caves, there were things like canteen and feeding arrangements and ambulance parks and maybe a tent or two. I think feeding arrangement, sort of marquee and so on. It was all quite well arranged. And there, I think, we had the first casualties brought back across the river to us in this cave. Now, and our transfusion and laboratory was there, but it was, in spite of all the elaborate arrangements, it was quite a temporary affair. And as soon as some territory had been cleared on the other side of the river, then we took this great laboratory and mobile service and went across a pontoon bridge. It was very exciting in a way, going across a pontoon bridge, which the Spanish engineers had organised so well. Across the River Ebro there, that they had spare pontoons concealed in various places along, not far away, where there was vegetation or something, to hide them from the aviation, because there were a lot of planes, and every day the Italian planes would come over and try and destroy this pontoon bridge, and indeed they hit it on numerous occasions. But since it was all sections, all standard-sized boats, when one was sunk, well, the same evening, under cover of dark, you might say, an exactly similar pontoon was floated into position, and early the next morning, or even the same night, things would be going across again. We went under cover of darkness. We went across it in the night, if I recollect. And it was, say, a very exciting incident, especially as there were planes around even then. And so we got across this pontoon bridge and drove up to a farmhouse a certain distance across very narrow roads. We had to stop every now and then and cut down a tree, because the road wasn't wide enough for this very wide vehicle we had. And we went and set up a little hospital in a farmhouse. And that was, I think it was there that I tried this cadaver blood, interesting thing. Anyway, we were digging ourselves shelters and things there. I can remember our chauffeur digging a trench beside the car, and he was a very energetic young man. Bucko was his name, which is, oddly enough, is short for Francisco, I think. Anyway, Paco dug us a nice shelter trench beside the vehicle, and he also cut down lots of branches of trees to camouflage it. And we served this little hospital where the wounded came in. I can't remember very much about the wounded in this situation. Again, it came in bits and pieces and spurts here and there, but we did have quite a lot, because it was a pretty fierce battle. They got a certain distance, and then they got stuck. There were certain fortified mountain peaks or tops of hills which the enemy held on to with great tenacity, and our men, with very little shelter, were trying to force their way up to the tops of these hills and being killed in great numbers. And there were sort of stony slopes with very little shelter. It was very, very hard going, and the thing more or less ground to a halt. All the time, because the enemy was throwing in more and more reinforcements and bringing to bear all their superior aviation and artillery, and we were always hoping that we should hear that from the Madrid side, the other attack would draw the enemy away, but they didn't. And so that battle once more came to an unhappy conclusion, with retreat back again across the River Ebro. This, we went back a different way, because we went over a bridge that was still intact. It was a railway bridge, I think. And certainly, we went back under cover of darkness, and it was, and we were sort of directed along the road all the way, so I didn't quite know how we did it, but we got over this bridge, and there certainly was a railway engine somewhere nearby, and we retreated back into Catalonia.
How were the evacuated wounded? How were they transported?
Well, many of them were got where there was where there were railway lines. They were taken down to these great ambulance trains that were fixed up with tiers of bunks on either side, and enormous numbers could be got in a long open but coaches which hadn't got seats, you know, just with bunks down either side. And ambulances, of course, motor ambulances were used too, but they couldn't take the numbers if necessary. Of course, some of the roads were terribly bumpy things too, and it wasn't nice for the anyone with an injury to be bumped along these terrible roads.
Were there any cases of gassing?
Gassing? No, not that I know of. It was always feared that there would be. And at one stage I spent a certain length of time at the gas warfare training establishment, I think in Madrid, to be instructed in gas warfare and casualties from gas warfare. And then, as expected, and I did in fact, go and give lectures in the Spanish language to others on the same subject. I mean, I was always have been in quite foolishly and confident that I could express myself in other people's languages once I'd tried to learn them. What should I say? Much overconfident in my capacities, in linguistic capacities. And so I gave this lecture about gas warfare in Spanish without much hesitation. How much they understood of it, Really? I don't know.
Were there any gas masks? Didn't they? Were there precautions people could take?
No. We were never issued with gas masks. Perhaps we hoped we might get them, but they never turned up, to my knowledge.
So what sort of advice were you giving about gassing?
Well, really, I think how to avoid it as much as possible, and how to recognise it, and how perhaps to treat victims and casualties, and what sort of injuries they might have. Phosgene gas is well known, of course, a terrible lung irritant causing acute bronchitis, pneumonia, and mustard gas, the terrible burns, and so on. Those are the things we were talking about. I still got somewhere, I think, what you'd call some kind of document, certificate, that I had passed through this course of study in at some specific date in this training institute, so that I've got my diploma. But I must say I've forgotten all about it.
So after this retreat from the Ebro, was that really the beginning of the end, did you indicate earlier on?
I would say so, yes. It was perhaps the last real big chance to get the enemy in a very sticky condition, because we would have exercised a sort of pincer movement behind his advance down to the Mediterranean from Teruel, and cut that little bit off, and it could have been smashed, so to speak, in a military sense. And this would have had a tremendous effect on morale all round. But of course, contrarywise, the morale lost in having to retreat back over the Ebro after all that fantastic preparation was terribly bad for our morale, and I think many of us must have felt, well, this is the end. Well, soon after that, in fact, negotiations in a political sense had been proceeding, perhaps influenced a bit by the United Nations, the League of Nations of those days, to withdraw all foreign troops from Spain. That included the international brigades on one side and the German battalions on the other. And Dr. Negrín was the Prime Minister at that time. He agreed to this and arranged for our departure from Spain. And there's an interesting cartoon that was shown later on, that was written about that time, I suppose. A cartoon of an Italian general, because there were some hundreds of thousands of Italians working for Franco. I forget how many, but it was certainly over 100,000, I guess, about three, I forget. A cartoon of an Italian general addressing the troops. He said, "You'll be glad to hear, I forget, you will have heard," he said, "that foreign volunteers are all being sent home from Spain almost immediately. However, this doesn't affect you, you're not volunteers."